history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this amazing country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some incredible stories just waiting to be told if we take a little time to ask the questions and listen. We want to honor our veterans, those who have served our country. Sometimes they serve in ways that we didn't consider before, and we're going to hear one of those stories today. But we want to make sure that we honor that service and sacrifice, that we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we always learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And all the great ideas for this show, all the veterans you meet, they usually come from listeners. You call me, you email me, you tell me, hey, go interview so-and-so. And we've got a loyal listener in Bakersfield, California, named Bill Bliss, who said, hey, are you going to be in Utah? You got to go talk to my mom. And she's got quite a story to tell, and we're going to hear it today. Viora Bliss Baldwin here in American Fork, Utah, beautiful spot beside the Wasatch Mountains where I watched the sun come up this morning. I bet you've seen a lot of those sunrises here.
Beautiful, beautiful sunrises.
And probably a little different from the sunrise in Vail, South Dakota, when you were a little girl. How big of a place was Vail, South Dakota?
About 250 people.
Well, that's a metropolis out there.
That's the township.
Uh-huh. So what was your childhood like there? I mean, a lot of people probably couldn't imagine being in that kind of spot in that time period here in the 1920s and 30s.
We lived on a farm and just raised a variety of crops, had a variety of animals, and my dad leased the farms for a long time, then he finally bought one of his own. He lost his first one during the Depression and had to start over.
Well, and for you, I know you had some brothers who I'm sure got big and strong helping around the farm and probably just walking against the wind you get out there in South Dakota. That's enough to keep you strong. What were the chores you had to do as a little girl?
We had to help around the house, help with breakfast and make school lunches and clean our rooms. Then we had to go. Sometimes I had to milk the cows in the morning if the men were busy and feed the chickens, gather eggs. Just the normal things children do on farms.
Well, I'm sure all your grandkids and great-grandkids have grown up doing those same things, right?
Not at all.
And you only have 24 grandkids and 31 great-grandkids. I'm sure they love your stories about back in South Dakota. And I'm just curious, a lot of people today, they can't even imagine a world without a smartphone, let alone a car and a refrigerator and electricity and indoor plumbing and all that. How many of those modern conveniences did you guys actually have out there on the farm?
We had none of them. We didn't even have a telephone or a radio. We got a radio in 1935. I remember that. And that was a gift.
So no electricity?
No electricity, no telephone, no water, no running water in the house. We had to go out to the pump and get our water and carry it in the house, use it there.
So bath time must have been fun with all your siblings and your folks.
It was. We had to use our big galvanized tub, and sometimes we had to share the water because there wasn't that much water.
You probably didn't want to go last on that deal, huh?
No, but I was one of the younger ones, so sometimes I had to be last.
And what about refrigeration? Now, you mentioned milking the cows, but how'd you keep that cool and consumable?
You know, it was really hard. We had a cistern with water in it, which was usually pretty cold, and we would put a bucket with what needed to be refrigerated and lowered into the cistern. And that kept it pretty good. We never had any food poisoning or anything, so I guess it was okay.
Sometimes simple is good. You know, you make things work. You know, I've heard some stories. I don't know what it is about you folks from North Dakota and South Dakota that made you so tough, but I've interviewed so many folks in their 90s that grew up there, live other places now, but they're still going strong. And when I rolled up to your house this morning, the first thing I saw was you pushing your trash can out to the street, so I know you've still got that. But I've heard some stories about how cold and windy it could get out there. I guess if you live in a place called Vail, you expect it to be a little windy, huh?
I think so. We did have a lot of wind. South Dakota has a lot of wind, and the winters were pretty tough sometimes. I remember my dad putting sleigh runners under his hay racks to pull them out to feed the cattle. And my brother one time ran his Model T car up over the fence where the drift was so hard that he didn't fall in. And then we used to dig holes in the snowbanks for the igloos. And, you know, when we were kids, we had a lot of fun in the snow and ice, but we still suffered it. When we went to school, we had to wear dresses in school, but we had to put on our snow pants and then take them off when we got to school. And our school was an old school, so we would huddle around the radiators to keep warm.
I'm sure. And you couldn't rely on a whole lot of body heat because I think you said your graduating class was only 10 people, right?
That's right. The whole high school was less than 50.
And I don't know if this is an easy question to answer. I know it's been a few years, but I can tell your memory's sharp. Thinking about all your granddaughters and great-granddaughters and the world that they're growing up in today, and I mean, they can imagine being anything in the world, and it's possible in today's world. But what did a little girl out on that farm in South Dakota dream of being when she grew up? What kind of options or ambitions or ideas did you have in your brain?
Well, I don't remember as a child, but I do remember in high school I wanted to be a nurse. So I didn't get to that point, but I did. After I retired, I took a medical assisting course and graduated from that, but my husband died right afterwards, so I didn't have a chance to pursue that.
You mentioned your father losing the farm during the Depression, and there's another thing that us folks today who didn't live through that, it's hard for us to understand or imagine what that must have been like during those times. What are the things that stand out for you that kind of illustrate the difference between times like that and the times we live in now?
Well, as children, we didn't notice what was going on like the adults did, but we always had food on the table because we had the farm and Mom preserved foods, but we always were able to do what we needed. We didn't have very many clothes. We'd have one or two new dresses a year, maybe, and maybe a pair of shoes when we got ready to go to school, but I can't think of anything particular. I do remember one time the bank coming and getting our cows because Dad hadn't been able to pay for them, and that was a hard thing.
And you mentioned you got a radio in 1935. That must have been a big deal for a little girl to hear these sounds coming from who knows where.
It was, and my older sister had gotten married, and they gave us a radio that first year. But before that, my brother had put together a little crystal radio that he could hear things on, and it was fun to try to listen on those. And then, of course, we had the cans with a string between that we would talk to each other. That seemed like a radio to us.
It's all relative. Well, mentioning your brothers, I know you had three of them that served in World War II. Were they nice to you? They treat you all right, or did they pick on you?
Well, they teased, but as long as they were teasing me, I knew they liked me. But my older brother, I don't, you know, he was about 10 years older than I was, so I don't remember him too much because he left when he was about 17, so I didn't have him around too long. But my other two brothers teased me a lot, and we had a lot of fun together.
And back on the radio idea, I imagine that's probably how you found out about December 7th, 1941, and what happened out at Pearl Harbor. Did you hear that on the radio?
I certainly did. I was at my girlfriend's house. We were on our way up the stairs, and I remember hearing it announced that time. We were in high school.
Did you grasp that? I mean, were you able to process what that meant? Was that a shock to the system? How did you digest that news over the radio?
Well, I already had one brother in the service at that time, so it meant a lot because they were in the Engineer Corps in the National Guard, and they had been called up to go into the service. So we were afraid for them. And then my younger brother joined the Merchant Marines, and he was in that for about 6 months, and he came home. Then he joined the paratroopers. And my older brother was in college in Chicago at the time, and he joined the Navy and became a chief warrant officer in the Navy. He was over salvaging ships during the war and was in the Indian Ocean, and the Japanese came and started bombing, and they had to pull him up too fast because he was down underneath. He got the bends and was in the hospital for 6 months, and we didn't know anything about it. We knew he was missing, but we didn't know what was happening to him.
Wow. And so people understand what you're talking about. So he was actually diving on ships that had been sunk, trying to salvage different things when the Japanese came to that very spot, bombed again. So they pull him up, but the pressurization left him in rough shape. The bends is something that those divers get, what they describe the effects of the body on that rapid pressurization process. So you guys didn't know anything? Your folks didn't know if he was alive or dead?
No, we didn't. And it wasn't until the Red Cross called us and told us it was about 6 months after he's missing that he was in the hospital in India.
Well, I'm interested in a couple things on that front. One for you as a sister, knowing you've got these brothers in harm's way, and in that case, you don't know if he's even still with us. And then your folks, do you remember how they handled that? Do you remember watching them deal with this reality of three boys overseas with their lives at risk? And how did they handle that?
It was hard because Dad really needed help on the farm, and he didn't have it with the boys gone, but he was always worried about him. And Mom, of course, worried a lot. I remember she had the stars. If they had a son in the service, they had a little flag in the window with a star on it, and she was proud to put those up. But she worried about it, too.
So there are three stars hanging in the window there.
Yes.
And I'm sure as a teenage girl, you probably wonder, well, what can I do to help? You could write your brothers some letters. You could pray for them. What else did you decide you could do?
Well, at that time, I couldn't do much else. I just write letters to them and keep them informed. But when I got a little bit older, I could.
So tell me about that. What did you decide you could do? Because we've heard a lot of stories from people in uniform, men and women in uniform during the war. But a lot of people don't even realize what else was happening here in the States while those millions of Americans were overseas. Tell me what you discovered that you could do to help that war effort.
Well, my friend and I decided to go to Denver, and we didn't really know what we were going to do, but we went to the employment agency, and they had a place where we could go to learn how to work on airplanes, and I loved it. I thought it was a lot of fun. She didn't like it. She went home a couple weeks later and got married, and I stayed there, worked in the modification center. It was where they built airplanes on the West Coast and would send them to Denver to be modified. And the airplanes were, you know, full-body airplanes like the ones they have for airlines without windows. But we put gun turrets in both windows and in the top and in the tail and under the pilot. That was our job. But when we started learning, we had to learn sheet metal, how to use sheet metal, and how to work on the radios. And we had quite a good education before we started working.
Is this something you were allowed to talk about with your family, with your friends? Or is this something that you had to kind of keep a secret, what you guys were doing there in Denver?
No, it didn't seem to be any secret at all. We all talked about it openly. Everybody knew what we were doing.
And we're going to learn more about that when we come back with 93-year-old Viora Bliss Baldwin of American Fork, Utah, the different skills she had to master as a Rosie the Riveter, the other nickname she and her fellow Rosies ended up sewing on their overalls in honor of their crew chief, and before we're done today, her sentimental journey to Washington, D.C. with Utah Honor Flight. Find photos of Viora and a video explaining how she keeps track of her 24 grandkids and 31 great-grandkids at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. You know, sometimes I get asked, when are you going to have some more women on the program? There were 16 million men in uniform during World War II, but also about 350,000 American women, and we've heard from them here over the years. You can pull up their stories at hometownheroesradio.com. Wasps and wax and waves and spars, women Marines, you name it. But there were also millions of American women who, although not in uniform, were still doing their part on the home front. Collectively, they'd become known as Rosie the Riveters. If you're ever in California's Bay Area, right on the east side of the Bay Bridge in Richmond is the Rosie the Riveter World War II Homefront National Historic Park. It's loaded with information and examples of the different ways in which these trailblazing women rolled up their sleeves, got to work, and proved they could, in fact, get the job done. The job for Viora Bliss Baldwin, 93 years young, whom we have the privilege of visiting with this time in American Fork, Utah, was to modify warplanes to help win the war and end it sooner. In Denver, Colorado, Continental Airlines ran one of the many modification centers across the country. And that's where Viora was. Was this a situation where you had one specific role in that you did over and over again, or did you have to learn different parts of that modification process?
We learned a lot of different parts. We learned how to cut sheet metal, and we learned how to rivet. We did an awful lot of that because you had to do that to put the gun turrets in. Then I had to learn some of the electrical work. I even remember changing a supercharger on an engine. That was kind of a good big job. We had crews of about 8 people each, and a crew chief, and he would tell us what we were doing that day, and we'd get busy and work. When I first started at that plant, there were only about 3 women there, and later on we had a crew of 8 women in our one crew, and the man that was our crew chief, when I first started, he didn't think women should be there at all, but he was really proud of his crew of 8 women when he got us working, because we worked hard.
Was this multiple different models of bombers, or was this like a B-24, B-17, B-29? What were you working on?
We worked on B-17s most of the time, and then toward the end, we worked on B-29s, but we didn't have as many things to do on the B-29s. We put some gun turrets in. But the biggest project I remember was putting an extra gas tank. The B-29 had 2 bomb bays, and they kept one for the bombs. And the other one, they put a real large fuel tank in so that they could go further. And that was one of our jobs, was to do that and get them ready for the big day.
I mean, you described that because you did it time and time again, and I'm sure it became routine for you after a while. But initially, that sounds like kind of a daunting job and a lot of responsibility there. You better not mess it up, because lives are going to be at stake flying that airplane, right?
That's right. We were really proud of being able to do what we could to help. And we had to be very careful, and we had inspections on everything we did. And it was always good because we were so careful.
One of the things that you hear about if you take the time to investigate the production of all the planes during World War II, one of the sources of pride would become how quickly Americans could turn out these bombers and get them overseas. So as each one crashed or ran out of gas or malfunctioned, here's another one to take the place. So as your guys are doing these modifications, how long would that process take? If you got an aircraft chassis in there, how long would it take to put in all the guns and the bomb bay doors and everything that you needed to do to get it operational?
I think it was about 21 days. We worked fast and we worked hard. So I don't know how many planes we did, but we were proud of them.
And was that hard work physically? Was this an all-day thing, a 12-hour shift? I mean, what kind of schedule did you keep?
We had 8-hour shifts, and every 2 weeks we would change the shift. We had 2 weeks for a day shift and 2 weeks for a swing shift, which was 3 to 11, and then 2 weeks for graveyard, which was 11 to 7. And we changed like that. I didn't think it was hard work because I'd been pretty used to working hard on the farm. But a lot of them thought it was hard. But we worked steady and we were very careful with what we did.
And you mentioned that when you first got there, the crew chief didn't think this was a job for women. Is that something that kind of rolled off your back at the time? Or did that say, hey, I'm a woman, I can do this?
I did think I was a woman and I could do it. And I did show them that I could. But that was kind of when they first started having a lot of women working. And it happened during the war, and it's been happening ever since. But we showed them we could do it.
I don't know if you remember seeing it then, but I'm sure you've seen it a million times since. Those, you know, classic illustrations of Rosie the Riveter personifying all of you women who went to work in this defense-related work so men could go overseas and fight. When you see a poster with Rosie with her sleeves rolled up and flexing that bicep and saying, we can do it, what comes to mind for you?
I remember the times that we did do it, and we just worked hard, and we looked kind of like Rosie the Riveter in that picture. We had our bandanas on and our coveralls on, and of course, I don't think she had coveralls. She had a shirt on, but we used to wear coveralls a lot because it was so much easier to get around in the planes, climb in and out and up and down.
And this may seem like a master of the obvious question, but this is long ago and far away in a different world compared to what we live in now. So why did you do it? What was your motivation? What drove you to give of yourself that way for the country?
Well, actually, at first, it was just going to be a job. I didn't know what we were going to be doing right at the first, but we were very proud that we were working on those planes and helping the country.
What would you say was the most difficult or challenging part of that job in the Modification Center?
I actually didn't think very much was challenging. I just, actually, the training to learn how to do all of it probably was the hardest part.
How many rivets do you think you put in?
Millions. We did a lot of them.
I bet if you close your eyes right now, you can probably hear that sound, huh?
Yes, I could. I hear it every once in a while when they're jackhammering out on the streets and think, oh, that sounds familiar.
Did you ever have any mishaps? Any funny things that happened or things you had to do over because they went unfortunately wrong?
I don't remember any. We had inspections so much that we had to get everything done right. I don't remember any mishaps at all.
And did you ever see some photos of some of those bombers and see what the crews had painted on the nose and say, hey, why'd you do that to my airplane that I fixed up for you?
No, I was glad they did. They had a lot of fun doing that, I'm sure.
Talked to a lot of guys. Maybe their fighter squadron has had reunions over the years, or their ship they were on in the Navy, ship's reunions. Armored divisions who are in Europe, they get together every year if they're still left. The Pearl Harbor survivors have their reunions. You telling me that you guys have had Rosie the Riveter reunions from your group from Denver?
Yes, there were about 8 of us that stayed together all the time, and we would have so much fun after the shift was over. The graveyard shift, we would go horseback riding and have breakfast out in the boonies, and we would have hay rides, and we would go down to Colorado Springs and go to the Garden of the Gods Easter services. just different things. And then after we had families, we had reunions. And one reunion, we were in Vail, Colorado, and we had one couple from Alaska, one couple from Alabama, one couple from California, two couples from Colorado, and one couple from Nevada, one couple from Texas. We had really traveled different places and settled different places, but we all got together. And we would do that about every 3 or 4 years for a long time. It's been a while now since we've had one, but it was so much fun. It was just so great. And I still keep in touch with a couple. There are just two of them left that we worked with. We're still dear to each other.
And there were about 8 of you to start with, is that what you said?
That's what we started running around with. We stayed on the same crew. Or one time we went down into the city and bought coveralls. Our crew chief's name was O'Leary, and he was an Irishman. So we went down and got bright green coveralls and had Leary's missing links, because he would come around and say, "Where is so-and-so? Where's my missing link?" So we put Leary's missing links on the back with Continental Airlines. And that he was so excited when he saw us. We went out and stood in front of him and then turned around so he could see it. But we had a lot of fun like that.
And I'm sure when you're busy doing this, you don't have a lot of downtime or time to sit around and wonder things. But did you ever wonder about what some of those particular aircraft you worked on actually did overseas?
Not very often, because we had a little newspaper that they put out, and they would have articles in there all the time about what was happening to a lot of the airplanes. So we pretty much knew what was going on. And then, of course, when we'd go to a movie, you'd get these big programs before the movie started telling all the news about the war and everything, so we could watch and see what happened to them.
And I guess, too, I mean, now you can look in hindsight and say, well, the war ended in August of 1945 and in Europe in May of 1945. But while you're doing this, you probably didn't know how long you were going to be doing that, huh? I mean, did you expect to just keep going for years if necessary?
You know, I don't remember even thinking about it. We just kept going as long as we were supposed to. Of course, as soon as the war was over, we were out of jobs. We had to do something else. But at the time, I don't remember thinking about how long we were going to be doing it. It's just day to day and doing what we could.
Well, and I'll ask you about that news of the war ending, but I guess more personal news for you was when your family finally found out that your brother was okay. You said you were unclear for about 6 months whether he was alive or dead. How did you guys get that news, and what did it mean to you?
Well, we got the news from the Red Cross, and of course, well, naturally we were jubilant about it. But it was a long time before we got to see him. It was after the war was over before we got to see him again.
And again, I know some of these sound real obvious or basic questions, but did you ever have that concern, lingering doubt, or fear that one or more of your brothers might not come home from the war?
Yes, we were afraid, because one of our neighbors had been with my brother when he was killed, and that brings it close to home. So then you think, you know, it could be any of them. My younger brother really wasn't in the actual battles very much. He was over in Japan and Philippines right after the war, but they were still cleaning up everything. I remember in the Philippines, they had to get so many Japanese out of underground caves where they had all their equipment and everything, and it took them a long time to get them all cleaned out of there. Then he went to Japan and worked there.
And that makes me wonder, too, when your brothers all came back, did you get them to talk much about what they'd done in the war, or were they ready to just get that part of their lives over with and not revisit it?
My younger brother, of course, talked more about it, but he wasn't in the actual battles. But my older brother, I wasn't around him a whole lot after the war, because he got married and stayed in California. So I wasn't around him for a whole lot. So I never did remember hearing him talk very much about it. And my other brother talked quite a bit about where they went, but not quite so much about the battles themselves. But they were in the engineer corps, and they had to go ahead and build bridges and things to get across rivers, and they were busy, and they were in the front lines, really.
I've talked to some of those guys. There's a whole contingent of them from the Dakotas and the National Guard there. In fact, they have a museum in Yankton to that unit I believe. And they were clearing minefields and building bridges all through North Africa and Italy, and pretty dangerous work. So you heard a little bit about that?
I did. And this brother went over right after Pearl Harbor, over to England. He went to Ireland first, then England, and then North Africa, and started up that direction, ended up in Italy and Germany.
Well, and you talked about your older brother getting married. You would get married not long after the war yourself, and I'm sure your seven kids and all your descendants are pretty thankful that your future husband made it through the war. How did you two meet?
Actually, we met where we were working. I was going to cosmetology school and working in the evenings in a restaurant. And when he went into the service, he had been working in the bank during the day and working at that restaurant at night. So I went in to get a paycheck one day, and he was there visiting with his friend, and he was trying to decide whether to work in the bank or work there while he went to school, go to school during the day and work there at night, or whether to work at the bank during the day and go to school at night. But I came in, and he saw me, and he asked him who that was. He said, "Well, I don't know. I know the other one. I took her home from a dance last night, but I want to know who that one was." So he told her that I worked there, and the next night he was working there. So he had plans. I think he got home in February. That was in March. So then we got married the next February.
You just told us what he thought of you, enough to switch jobs for, but what did you think of him?
Well, I enjoyed him after I got to know them. First night I was there, he asked if he could take me home, if I had a ride home, and I looked out and saw some friends waiting for me. Then a couple nights later, we went out afterwards and danced, and we had a good time.
What did he do during the war?
He was in the Coast Guard. He was served over at Guam for a while, and then he had to go back to Hawaii for some surgery, and then about that time, the war was over.
And, you know, we've gotten a picture through your family and your perspective. We've gotten a little slice of how everyone in America was involved in this. This was an all-consuming situation. The world was at war, and our very freedom was at stake, and all your brothers were out there participating. You found your way to participate. When that war was all over, when it was no longer in doubt, when freedom had been secured and victory had been achieved, did it feel different? Was it easier to go on with your life? Did you have some new sense of hope or optimism that maybe was in question during the war years?
I'm sure that we did. It was a hard thing to decide what I was going to do after the war, because all of a sudden I had gotten out of high school and gone to work, and then I had to decide what to do, and I wanted to be a nurse. And I tried several places to be a nurse, but wherever I was going, it was going to have to be that I would be on 24-hour call, and I couldn't work, and I had to work to keep money. So I finally decided to go to cosmetology school for a while, and that's what I did.
Well, and then you became a mom and a grandma and a great-grandma, and that could be a full-time job when I look at the size of your family.
That's right. It is a great-time job, and unfortunately, I worked a lot during the time that the grandchildren were little, and some of them weren't close, but I didn't get to spend as much time with the grandchildren as I would have liked to have, but I really enjoyed it when I saw them.
And we're enjoying getting to know Viora Bliss Baldwin today and hearing about an often overlooked but vitally important element of the Allied victory in World War II, the contributions of so many Americans, men, women, and children on the home front. We'll hear the rest of Viora's story, including her experience with Utah Honor Flight, when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days. And you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Nearly 1,000 veterans have gotten to see their memorials for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
Inspiring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Loeffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an eye-opening conversation with 93-year-old Viora Bliss Baldwin today. We've heard about her childhood in rural South Dakota without any of the modern conveniences that we don't think we could live without today. How after high school, she moved to Denver to be a Rosie the Riveter, modifying American planes. Continental Airlines ran a modification center there that added gun turrets, installed bomb bay doors. There in Denver, they worked on B-17s, even P-51 Mustang fighter planes, and eventually B-29 bombers like the ones that would decimate Tokyo. Of course, there were some other B-29s modified a little differently in what they called silver plate fashion that would drop atomic weaponry on Hiroshima and Nagasaki and accelerate the surrender of Japan. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll see what Viora looked like in her Rosie the Riveter days, as well as her nonagenarian smile, which was beaming broadly on her trip to Washington, D.C. in 2016 with Utah Honor Flight. And I want to talk to you about the honor flight, as I said. But when you think about that role that you played, as some have put it, stepping into what a man would have been doing, but in the process proving what women were capable of, and working on planes that would eventually bring the war to an end. When you look back on what you did for that brief time, what gives you the most pride?
The fact that we did, were able to just help to do whatever we could during the war. I'm just really proud of being able to help.
And other than that initial comment from your crew chief that you shared with me that he didn't think women should be there doing that, did you ever encounter those kind of sentiments or any kind of bias or discrimination just because you're a woman?
Not other than that, I don't think. I don't remember anyway.
So you're saying they figured out pretty quick they shouldn't mess with you? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, don't mess with the women. We can do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and now you've got 70 years of history since that. When you look at how the world has changed, do you look back and feel like what you and those other ladies did have something to do with that, with the opportunities that your daughters and granddaughters and great-granddaughters have had?
Yes, I do. I think the women during the war working like they did has paved the way for other women to take part in different businesses and manufacturing and everything. So it was the beginning of the women being out and around.
And people who listen to this show have heard a lot about Honor Flight. It's happening all over the country where volunteers get together and take veterans free of charge to Washington, D.C. so they can see the memorials that honor those who never came home. It's been happening in Utah here for quite a long time, and they've done a marvelous job of getting veterans to Washington, D.C. But a lot of times, people like you who weren't technically in the military don't get a chance to go. So someone must have made a pretty strong case that what you did during the war mattered and was deserving. How did you find out that you were getting to go on this special trip to our nation's capital?
Actually, we were at a wedding reception one night, and my grandson knew this man that had worked with the Honor Flight, and he told him about me, and so they invited me to go. And I was the only one on our flight that wasn't a veteran. I was rather intimidated at the time because I was afraid that they would think I was out of place. But they were all very nice. They said, "We couldn't have done it without you." And I said, "You know, that's right. If you'd have had airplanes up there with no gun turrets, you wouldn't have had much luck."
What do you remember about that experience? What are some of the things you got to do, and what did it mean to you?
The whole group met. When we met the first morning, there was a brass band there and honoring us, and they had the mayor there, and we got to see our senator when we were in Washington. But they were so good. They were divided into two groups, and each busload had a woman who was in charge, and they had everything just down pat. They knew what was going on, and they knew how to get things done. When we went to the airport, we were met by a band that had bagpipers. They played for us, and then as we went through the airport, everybody stood up and applauded. It was exciting. And they had three women who were dressed like the Andrews sisters, and they were very popular during the war, so they sang songs that they sang during the war. One young man asked me to dance with him, and I danced with him. That was fun. We had to each have a guardian, they called it, with us. And everybody had to have a wheelchair, so the guardian pushed the wheelchair. And we could get out and walk around if we wanted to, but we had to have the wheelchair with us. They had asked the guardians to get letters from the families, so they had mail called during the flight. So there were a lot of tears on a nice letters. But then actually we stayed in Maryland, and we arrived there, and then they had a dinner that night for us, and they had entertainment. Every place we went, we were welcomed with band music, and they took us from one memorial to another. And they advised us that the Washington Monument was the only monument in the city, that the rest were memorials. The memorial for the World War II was a new one to me. I hadn't seen that before. I'd seen some of the others, and it was a new one, and it was gorgeous. It was just beautiful.
And I'm just thinking back to what we've discussed. We talked about your three brothers who were all serving during the war. You were doing your part in the Modification Center, working on those bombers. And you mentioned that when your brother went missing, that there was a neighbor of yours from South Dakota who had been killed that day. Did you think about him when you looked at all those gold stars at the World War II Memorial?
Yes, I thought about all the young men who were gone. You can't help but think about it. Just do your part and try to get them back.
Do you remember his name, the neighbor who was killed in the war?
Charlie Bader, B-A-D-E-R. He was killed in Italy. And I knew a few other families who had young people killed, but I didn't have anybody in our own family, thank goodness.
And you lived through it when it happened. But being there at that World War II memorial, and you know, you've got all those pillars for every state. You've got South Dakota where you grew up. You've got Utah where you live now, other states that you've lived. You've got the different battles that are depicted. There's some storyboards and then engraving on some of that stone, the fountain, and then those gold stars, 406,000 Americans who didn't come home from the war. Was that a lot to try to digest? Even though you lived through the time, was it kind of overwhelming to see all of that in that setting?
It was overwhelming, and it was difficult because we didn't really have enough time to linger long enough to see everything, but the plaques that were around there were just beautiful. They had, I think they were in copper plaques, and then they had the big memorials for each state. Yeah, it was fun to go back and see the one that was for your own states and the place states you'd lived in. It was just exciting to see it all in the beautiful water with the fountain in the middle, and on each end of the memorial they had a one was for the Pacific and one was for the Atlantic, and each one had these huge eagles that weighed tons. It's a wonder they could hang them up there and keep them there. But they were just beautiful. Then another memorial that I hadn't seen was Franklin D. Roosevelt, and they had a lot of memories in there. They had one place where they showed people sitting around listening to the radio for the announcement, and I found out that Eleanor Roosevelt was our first representative to the League of Nations. There were just so many things. We went by the Iwo Jima Memorial and stopped at the gravesite where Kennedy is buried. The Vietnam Memorial with all the names on it, it brings back to you what's happened. I had seen that before, but it seemed more important this time.
And you mentioned the mail call. So many servicemen experienced that during the war, and you guys had that on the flight where you get all these letters and notes, and you've got a big family. I'm sure you had tons of mail. I bet coming back to Salt Lake was pretty special, too.
Yes, it was. We all had our families there to greet us, and the kids had made posters to welcome me home. And then they had the governor of Utah spoke to us. A group of motorcycle warriors, and I can't remember what they called them, they led the buses to the airport, and again, they led us back to the armory when we got back. When we got to the airport, they would stand in there with their flags to honor us as we entered. And the same thing when we came back out, they would have their flags, and then they'd get on their motorcycles and lead us back. They were very nice, and they presented me with a flag that I use. And then they gave us each a book, showing a lot of the people that were on our flight and the stories about each one. They gave us each a book that night about the building of the memorial, and that's a very interesting book. And they handed me mine, and then they took it back again and said I'd be getting it in the mail. And when they did, they had a couple posters of Rosie the Riveter in there. Uh-huh. That was the only difference. They wanted it to be special, so that was nice.
Well, it sounds like this whole thing had to make you pretty special. I'm sure there are many years of your life where you felt like nobody cared about that time that you spent in the war and what you did. But now you get a free trip to the Capitol. You're cheered as a hero all over Washington, D.C. Your Senator Orrin Hatch is there to greet you. The governor's here waiting for you when you get back. How did that whole thing make you feel about what you had done?
I was proud again of what we had done, and it really brought back a lot of memories.
Well, and I realize that I neglected to ask you something important, too, about at the memorial. I asked if you're thinking about your brothers or the neighbor that had died, but you've been widowed twice, and both of your husbands served in World War II, and they didn't get to go to that World War II memorial. I bet you thought about them when you were there.
I did. Would have been nice if they could have gone. There's so much of it that's been built since they were gone. But it was a very, very, very nice trip, and it was quite an honor.
Well, is there anything else that I haven't asked you about that you think is important for people to know about that time in our history and what we can learn from it now?
I just want people to know that it was a very important time, and we did all we could.
What do you think the biggest difference is between America then in America now?
Oh my goodness, I can't tell you. The electronic age is here, and I don't understand it all, but I try to keep up with it. But there's so many things that are different. The kids think I'm crazy when I tell them some of the things that we used to do and the games we used to play and how we lived at that time. It's just so different. It's hard to keep up with.
I've had a lot of veterans say that they wish we could get back to the unity that America displayed during World War II. What do you think caused that? Where do you think that came from?
I just remember how patriotic everybody was at that time. And you don't see that now. I think it's just that everybody worked so hard to make everything go on and work together. Families were together more, I think. We all sat down at the table together, and now they sit in front of the TV and eat their dinners, and it just is a lot different.
Well, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for finding a way to serve our country during World War II, and thank you for telling us about it. Is there something that now at 93 you'd say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
I'm thankful for my childhood. I had a good family. I had a good childhood. I had work experience when I went to work later on, and I think that's the thing that I'm most proud of.
And what about unfinished business? You still have something on your list that you haven't done yet that you're hoping to pull off?
No, just live till tomorrow each day.
And I have to imagine that you've been asked this once or twice if you've got 7 kids and 24 grandkids and 31 great-grandkids. What about any advice, any wisdom that you've picked up along the way that you think those of us younger folks should keep in mind?
I think to show love to your family and keep them together. And one of the things I think is really important is getting together at dinner time. It's the time we had the most fun at our house, was dinner time. And you could visit and see what's going on. Have a special time to find out what's going on in your families. That's one of my favorite things.
And no smartphones.
Yeah, get off the smartphones. See a picture of Grandma coming to visit, and everybody's anxious to see her, and they're sitting around looking at their smartphones.
Well, you wouldn't get away with that if Viora's around, as her daughter Leslie knows quite well. With the brief time we have left today, let's hear from Leslie about what she's picked up from her mom's life and example.
I just feel that my parents, mom coming from the background she came from, and my father coming from the background that he came from, just really gave them a patriotism that was passed on to us as children. And we've all been very patriotic. Every year, every holiday, we would go, all of us, seven children and my parents, and we'd have to go out and hang the flag in front of the neighborhood. And it was always a little embarrassing at the time, but it taught us great patriotism. You know, we were definitely always the first ones that stood when a flag went by at a parade and so forth. So the patriotism that they feel has gone on to our families. And my son, for instance, leads some bravery from heroes past. And I just think that it just continues on and on. And it's come from her parents, my dad's parents, all the way through. That's the greatest thing, I think, that's come from my parents, is our patriotism.
Another legacy that Viora Bliss Baldwin can be very proud of. Don't forget to check out the photos, a brief video, and other information at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Thanks again to Viora's son Bill for bragging on his mom a little bit and cluing me in. And thank you for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.